With what?
Crystalloid.
Crystalloid.
What is it?
Crystalloid.
Crystalloid?
Crystalloid. All right, we'll start over again. We'll start over with the lab test. You want to, when you're evaluating your patients, in addition to the diagnostic test, which was your x-rays, bless you, your MRI, CAT scans, we want to get lab tests. And the lab tests that are very important, several of those, the first one being our hemoglobin and hematocrit. And with our, anybody who has a fracture, anybody who's lost volume or concerned, they're going to go into what kind of shock? Right. And the fluid choice for anybody would be a crystalloid. An example of a crystalloid fluid would be Ringer's lactate or normal saline, right? Normal saline and Ringer's lactate are your crystalloids, right? Your hypotonic would be D5 normal, D5 half normal, and then your isotonic. Your normal saline is considered an isotonic, but it's also a crystalloid. Your colloids would be more of your plasma, your blood replacements. Those are your colloids. Just think anytime you need anything, they have larger molecules in them, and that's why your crystalloids and your colloids are have large molecules, and they replace volume. So anytime you need volume, you need saline or you need Ringer's lactate. Ringer's lactate has more electrolytes in it, so anybody that you think may need to have some electrolytes replaced also. And even with trauma, we start out now with normal saline, and then we may switch over to Ringer's. Okay, just remember, anybody, though, you're replacing the volume, you're giving a lot of volume back to with the hypovolemia. You want to make sure that it's warm fluid if you can. There's nothing worse than having ice cold, lots of fluid infused.
So it can't be room temperature? Is room temperature?
Room temperature is okay, but if you're giving a lot of volume replacement, you should really warm the fluid.
Oh, really?
Right, because you can cause arrhythmias if it's cold.
Yeah, how do they warm
the fluid?
Well, we have, in the hospital, we have blood warmers and we have fluid warmers. It's not recommended to put them in the microwave.
Right.
That is not recommended. Wrapping them in warm towels. For the patients that get peritoneal dialysis, you have the K-pad. You can wrap them in those. That's really what we recommend. You don't want it hot, just warm. Some of the areas have a warmer, like the down in the trauma room, surgical ICU, open heart. Some of the areas have an actual warmer. It looks like a refrigerator, but it's a warmer. And we keep all our fluids right in there. So you could get those if you needed them. Your CPK shows muscle breakdown. And you have CPK for muscle. You'll also have different indicators. So you have a CPK-MB, which is related to the heart. So there's different, you know, CPK readings. So, but CPK level will give you a breakdown of muscle. So you know if you've had, you know, damage or an injury, you know that you've had a lot of muscle breakdown if the patient's CPK level is very high. It's muscle breakdown, what it actually completely means. Is creatinine phosphokinase. Okay, so that's an indication of muscle breakdown. And you will see it with your different types of patients, but just always remember, though, there's different CPK levels because it's muscle, but if it's specific to general muscle or specific to the heart, like the heart is CPK-MB. That means it's related to the heart. There's different.
So a higher CPK level will mean more breakdown?
More muscle breakdown, yes.
Is that, never mind, I won't go that far.
All right.
I don't want to do that to you.
Thank you. And no. You can ask me next week in clinical.
Yeah,
how's that?
Okay.
Still, write the question down. No, any questions, write down in clinical. I don't want to. Never discourage questions.
No.
Any questions again?
No.
But write it down, save it for me.
Track again, and I don't want you to.
Okay, save it for next week.
Yeah.
I'll always answer it for you. The serum, the CGOT is a serum glutamic oxalate. You don't have to write this all down. Triasminase, which is an enzyme in the liver, and also an enzyme that you see in all muscle, smooth, skeletal, and cardiac muscle. Why it's important is that if you have a patient that has a high SGOT level, but all their other liver enzymes are okay, then that means that it's specific just to the muscle and there's no liver damage. If all your liver enzymes are elevated in addition to the SGOT, then you may have muscle in addition to having liver damage. Right? Was that the point you wanted to make with them, with the SGOT? Because it was in your note.
Oh, was it? Oh, yeah, it probably was.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I'm not thinking that. I'm just sitting here listening.
Oh, okay, all right. Taking this on. that's what I think is the hardest with all of you, because I'm not sure to what detail sometimes to go or what you, how much you want them all to know. I think we were all getting comfortable even like last week with looking at different lab values, and sometimes different labs will stand out. What did we look up last week? It was the LDL. And there's a lot of things, and that's the best thing to do is what we did, I thought, last, you know, pull out our reference book, see what it actually stands for, because you'll never remember all of these, and sometimes it's combinations of them that can tell you a lot about your patient. The PT, PTT, we want to know that because of their clotting factors, right? Prothrombin time, right? And that's really important, especially someone that we have on anticoagulants.
They turned that on.
Yes. Yes, they did. And actually, sometimes the SGOT and is it I think it's the ADH are the same thing. The liver, just always think SGOT is a liver enzyme or a muscle enzyme. And remember, we talked about muscles, and I mentioned you have three different types. You have the smooth muscle, right? You have the cardiac muscle, and then you have your skeletal muscle. PT, PTT, clotting, very important. That's why that's done routinely. Check your PT, PTT, and your INR levels with that. Electrolytes. What electrolytes are we concerned with? Potassium, right? Calcium, sodium. How about magnesium? Magnesium is very important for muscle, and sometimes we'll even check a zinc level. Okay, because zinc, if your zinc levels are too low, your tissues won't heal properly. You'll have a poor healing process. And some medications that you may give your patient, and one of the big ones being one of our sedatives, we give them a lot, is that Diprovan. It's like a chalky sedative. It cuts down on your zinc level. So you want to always keep in mind if your patients have poor tissue healing, when you look up your meds, now you're being really thorough with the meds you look up. If it says, you know, affect zinc metabolism, may affect magnesium, that's significant, especially if you know someone's got a lot of injuries or a lot of damage. B1 and creatinine we talked about, and why are those so important?
Kidney function,
right. And some patients may go into acute renal failure just from the shock of whatever happened to them. Okay, so you always want to keep that in mind in whatever medications you're giving them. A urinalysis is really important. What can the urinalysis tell you?
Renal failure also, right?
Renal failure, blood in the urine, right? Maybe you have, in addition to your broken ribs in the back, you also have a lacerated kidney, right? Bleeding. What did you say? Hmm? Did you say something else?
No.
Proteins, right. Sugar. Right, protein, sugar, right. If you're overhydrating them, you know, your serum osmolarity will tell you a lot in your urine, whether your specific gravity will tell you. If you're giving them too much fluid, all right, good. And then the RH factor is important because that'll tell you about your patients that have arthritis. Right? And your sedimentation rate, okay, will tell you about concerns with arthritis and different type of congenital problems. Okay, so that was the heavy part. Okay, now we'll get into some of the different types of fractures and that you might see, and then we'll go into some of the different types of injuries that may occur. Looking at our classification of fractures, you can either have a pathologic fracture, which is caused from a trauma where you, or in a diseased bone. Sometimes the bone is very weak. It's just a minor trauma. I just bumped my arm. It shouldn't break that easy, but if I find out that I had osteoporosis in that area or I had severe arthritis, it will break much easier. A stress, fatigue, repeated trauma, you know, a lot of the athletes, you notice they constantly hit the same area, it's going to break. The muscles are going to break down, the ligaments are going to tear, and you're going to break the bone. The traumatic injury is more of when you actually have an impact. You know, if I ran into the back of that wall head first, I may fracture my skull or something, you know, falls from the sky and drops on my head, the same thing could happen.
Chicken little.
So there's different causes. If you do have a pathologic fracture, you always want to kind of figure out why, you know, and those are the patients that we're concerned. What's their underlying comorbidity? Do they possibly have cancer in the bone? There's so many things that can cause it, and you really need to find out what caused that fracture. Looking at your different types of fractures associated with those, you also have tissue involvement. And they classify them with depending on what type of tissue involvement you have. And then you also have, if you have a fracture where it doesn't break the skin, it's considered a closed fracture. So, you know, people that, if I broke my arm, the bone's broken underneath, but you don't see any bone protruding through the skin, that's a closed fracture. Our open or our compound fracture is when the bone comes through the skin and protrudes. Have you seen compounds? That's what you had. And where was your fracture? Your femur, wow. How'd you do that?
I have
Traumatic. A traumatic fractured femur. And we'll get into that next, see if she had any of that. Because that carries, that's a serious injury. That's significant. How long ago was that?
It was 2 months before my fifth birthday.
Oh. Wow.
Your poor mother.
Mm-hmm. That's why you went to nursing school? And so the career path was that. With your other classifications, you also use, we'll get into why you're concerned with, you have different complications that occur with an open compound fracture versus a closed, different complications than different grades of soft tissue injuries, how they may rate. Now, you being new, and even a lot of us in the hospital, the doctors don't always say that you have a fractured femur with a grade 3A, but you know as it goes up in grades that it's a lot more tissue damage. So our highest grade being our grade 3C is an open fracture with a arterial injury associated. So that's a fracture with a very deep vascular damage associated with it versus our grade 1, which is a fracture with maybe a very small, 1 centimeter is a tiny laceration or wound.
And remember, at least my clinical group a couple weeks ago, Fran gave out a handout. Well, one of you got a handout from somewhere. I thought it came from you on lung cancer.
No, that was Lauren.
About the grading of lung tumors. So grading, staging, these are terms that are used in various areas, and usually they mean in general the same thing, that the more numbers or dots behind the line need more extensive invasion.
Right. More so because they do have liver levels, stages, and it's true. As the numbers go up, it definitely is more significant of an injury and more involvement in other areas. Different types of classifications of bone fractures, and on your little handout we'll pull out in a minute, and you can look at some of those. A complete would be a break through the entire bone. So that's a significant break because now you remember we saw that before, all the vasculature, it's completely through, so you probably did sever an artery, you have torn vessels, you've broken through everything. Incomplete is a partial break, a green stick, pretty common, incomplete fracture it's called. Your displaces, bone fragments separate from the fracture line. And we're concerned with that displacement because once that happens, right, all those edges are jagged. And everything they come in contact with now are going to rip, tear, shear vasculature. And that's why it's so important that we immobilize and we splint these things in place so they don't cause more damage.
When they say a hairline fracture, is that the same thing as a green stick? Or?
Similar to a green stick, yes. Yeah, exactly. It's just a mild fracture, not completely through. It's just a partial break. Common unit is 3 or more fragments, bone at a fracture line, so that's a significant fracture. Impacted compresses or telescope fracture, your vertebrae that usually happens with, they all get compressed together, and you can have several of those broken. Overriding, I have a nice picture of an overriding, and that usually happens a lot with the femur or your long bones where you have a significant break, and it completely separates. It overrides the other bone. So that's a real big damage. That an overriding fracture, there'll be no missing. That's one that has obvious deformity that would hit you as soon as you looked, and a lot of swelling you see associated with that. You can look on your handout that I gave you. It does have a picture of the green stick. You can see the displaced fracture, and that one is actually a fracture with one or both or all fragments of normal alignment, and that's a direct energy force. And actually, we had someone the other day who had a displaced fracture. It was her forearm. She said she fell and landed like this. And it looked more like she got hit, though, because she fractured ulna and a radius almost directly across from each other. And a fracture like that would need a plate because now that you have a separation in the same area, it's very unstable. So that wouldn't heal without having a surgical intervention. You can see your green stick is pretty common, breaking only one cortex of the bone. You have different layers, so it didn't get all the way through. So you have your the compression fracture was in there. That's pretty common in the vertebrae. A lot of axial force, again, jumping, a lot of different ways that could happen. Okay, looking at this picture here, I don't know how many of you can see the knife up at the top. Yeah, see that butcher knife through there? So it broke the bone, and it also lacerated everything in its path. And that went completely through. So you could have a blunt, which means it's, from the force that caused the fracture. You can have a penetration, which is when something has actually been penetrated into the body. And this picture being a knife was placed in that area. So that's a significant fracture and a lot of vascular damage associated with that. Bless you. We'll go through each one of these other areas. We're going through fractures now, but then we'll go through a little bit about dislocations, sprains, ligaments, tears, and then the neurovascular compromise. All of them have neurovascular compromise with them, whether it be a bone fracture, as soon as you have soft tissue with it, or any vessels, you're always worried about the vascular damage. The first one of our soft tissue injuries, and I'm sure we've all had at one point of our lives, a contusion, which is just a hematoma or bleeding into the soft tissue. So it's smarts, it hurts, it swells. Ice now has been considered controversial with taking the inflammation away. It's really for comfort, but not so much for any kind of healing. So we do want a little bit of that inflammation. We expect to see that. A strain is when you actually have a microscopic tear in the muscle from exertion of a muscle. We've all had a muscle pull. You may have some bleeding into the tissue even with a muscle pull. And it can be painful. You may see a lot of swelling. Your sprain is more of your tearing injury. That's where the fibers and attachments to the ligaments and tendons are actually torn. And you may have bleeding into the tissue with that also. That is extremely painful, a very long healing process. And that's why a lot of times it's better healing if you just broke it than if you just stretched it and sprained it. Everybody's had a sprain? No? No sprains?
Oh.
So you had the tendons, you had the sprains. Yeah. What'd you sprain? Your ankle.
At work.
At work. Eric, too? You did, too?
Yeah. I used to run cross country and all these things. It was a nice little hill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And once it goes over once, different from like the fracture, you get the stability back in the bone. You strain something, it's always going to be sensitive, and ankles especially. Once you twist them once, they go. And so it can be a recurrent injury and a weakened area. Looking at some fracture planes, you have different ones. And you can see even on the handout that I gave you, the longitudinal extends in the same direction, so it goes in the line of the bone. The transverse is a 90-degree angle across the bone shaft, so it's a significant fracture. The spiral goes completely around, and I think there's a spiral in there. Oh, right, you have a good picture of a spiral. You see the open fracture there. Okay, so they're all significant. The pathologic, you can see that one, how it shows you that you have a diseased area in the bone, and that's why that broke. And that you probably wouldn't notice until you, like, they may never know they have that until it actually breaks, and then they get the x-ray done, and that's when they see that there's that hot spot there. Straddle. Okay, you have also your compression crush type of fracture, and that can be, you mentioned the back, but it can be in other areas too. Any bone can be compressed or crushed. Avulse is when you have a chip. I think we've all thought at one point in our life you avulse that coccyx, the little flap there, but usually it's still hanging on, but it's not completely taken off. An avulse fracture is a chip fracture with the muscles contract forcefully, and it actually causes a little piece of the bone to snap off. So it's painful. That's usually seen on an x-ray. A depressed fracture is one where the fracture line is lower than the surrounding bone tissue. And we get, when you palpate, you actually feel the depression. You feel a soft area. When you do the scalp, we get a lot of depressions in the scalp area, the skull, and you feel a soft spot. Sometimes it heals on its own. If it's enough of a depression, though, where it's deep enough, it's then going to compress vital areas. So a lot of times they have to go to surgery, have a plate put in there, have it lifted to get it off the vasculature. And most commonly we see those in the skull or the head. So they don't always need surgery, but sometimes they do if it's significant. With your injuries, you always have to suspect. Anytime you have a muscle tear, a sprain, a strain, a fracture, musculoskeletal injury, you always want to be concerned with neurovascular status. How well are they perfusing? What kind of function do they have? With our pelvic fractures, we carry a very high risk. We mentioned about the bleeding. And the men, unfortunately, carry your urethras are a little bit longer. So that's why they're most commonly injured more than the females. So you get a lot of pelvic injury. You get a lot of blood loss because of how your anatomy is set up. Extremity injuries, if you have enough of a force to break, you know, your arms, enough of a force to break your ribs, you most likely jarred your spinal column too. So that's why we always suspect a neck injury or a back injury when you have a high force type of an injury occurring. with your all of these injuries, you can get muscle spasms. The muscles just go into they react, and then they can't contract properly, so you get the muscle spasms. Not only are they painful for people, everybody's had muscle spasms. They're very painful, and sometimes they mask the pain of the injury, but they also, especially in the rib area, if you took an x-ray with someone right off the bat who's having muscle spasms in the rib area, you wouldn't see the fracture because it can actually hide the view of the bone itself. So that's why a lot of times patients will be sent back for another x-ray, or even though they don't see an actual break, they'll say you have a possible fracture, and then they'll get a second x-ray and confirm it. So once those spasms go down, you can usually tell for sure. With your fractured femur, I don't know if you remember, you're younger, but that also, they have a lot of serious muscle spasms with that. And once you align it and get that leg stabilized, once you have mobilization for any type of injury, once you stabilize it, it'll usually cut down on those muscle spasms and patients will feel a lot better. You may get them now in the hospital where they're in bed, they're not moving around enough, and that too can cause muscle spasms. So being immobile is not good. And a lot of patients, when they're laying still, they're just not used to it, and they will have a lot of muscle spasms. Okay, a little bit about pathophysiology. There's three areas that carry a very high rate of losing a lot of blood volume. A fractured humerus, which is where? All right, your upper arm. Upper arm, that's a pretty big bone. Your femurs. Okay, and then we have our pelvis. Right, and the pelvis, with the femur, you can lose up to 1,500 and a pelvis. That's a lot of blood, 1,500 milliliters of blood just with a fracture. And the humerus, a lot of people say the humerus is no big deal, but the humerus is a large blood volume can be lost in that area. So any one of those areas, you're always concerned with that patient going into hypovolemic shock or becoming volume depleted. So our goal really as nurses and medical professionals is to make sure we have a mechanism to minimize the damage. So we want to right away get the clotting system, make sure it's working, give them the volume, give them back the blood replacement if they need it, get that cellular membrane integrity, and we want the collateral flow. And to get that collateral flow, that's just putting it in back in, mobilizing it in a where it can function. So it's in, you're getting the blood flow back. So if my foot was like this, that's why they reduce it, so that you're getting the flow back and you get that collateral circulation back to that area.
So when a child falls, let's say a child, they fall off the monkey bars or whatever, that's usually it's usually from a fall, and they fracture, because I've never heard so much talk about blood loss, but with breakage of bones. Now when the EMTs and stuff come, they comfort them, but should they start IV fluids immediately on them?
No.
When it's a concern with that?
Depends on what bone it is. Again, with the femur and the pelvis, yes.
Yeah.
With femur and pelvis, yes, but not with forearms, ankles, no, lower legs, no, not necessarily.
Okay.
These are the ones that carry a high risk, and not all of them have a significant blood loss, or not all of them go into shock. Just know that they can lose a large amount of blood. Now, if you had how bad was your fracture? Open. She had a compound open fracture. She's probably a much higher risk than if she had a simple fracture of the femur. And if she didn't have pulses, and if you don't have, there's a lot of other reasons why you might want, but you don't always need the medics or ALS with that. As long as it's splinted, and that's the first thing you can do is immobilize it, because you're going to prevent further damage, you're going to get the collateral blood flow back, and sometimes they need oxygen, sometimes you don't even need oxygen. Now looking at this injury here, here's where you have a fracture, but you also have a laceration. Just by looking at that, you can tell it's probably what? Clean or dirty?
Dirty,
right? So what's an open route there? We just have a direct path now into the system for infection. Okay, so with any kind of an open wound, especially a deep wound, you carry the risk of always a high rate of infection as our first concern. And then you have the nerve and the vascular damage. So with the nerve injury, they may not be able to move their fingers. They may not be able to feel as well. This is an injury that's going to have to be irrigated. Hopefully that IV is not going in that arm, right? We would prefer to put it in the other arm. Maybe that's the only vein, though, they had. I don't know if they're above or below that. Or they may have been using the IV just to irrigate. So we're hoping that that's what they were doing. The injury distal to the nerve may result in loss of motor sensory function, and with that comes a lot of pain. If your nerves are compressed and you have an open wound like that, they're going to be in a lot of pain. And again, the more pain, the more chance the muscle spasms, and then the whole thing develops. And sometimes even as nurses, that's where we play a big part, because the doctors are great with a lot of things, but they kind of forget that these people You know, they need pain control. You know, this is a, and psychologically, this could be a devastating injury in addition to the pain, so that just adds to the whole, you know, sequela. So that's a, looking at that, and anytime there's a break in the skin, you always be concerned with infection. With a deep injury like this, we're always thinking, with infection, that patient's probably going to need what? Antibiotics, right? Right. And what else? What does everybody get? What are we concerned with a laceration or an open wound? Your tetanus shot. Right. When was your last tetanus shot? Right. And now we go with the rule is 10 years. If you don't remember when you had your last one, it's 10 years. But if you can't remember, you get one. Okay. And most of you, you know, most of the people that are younger in school that have had their routine tetanus shot, but you'd be surprised sometimes you may find someone that hasn't. You know, a lot of construction people are injured quite a bit. You know, some people know right away when their last shot was. Some people can't remember. But then you start always asking them, did you have a cut recently? Did you fall recently? Did you have an injury? And then they'll remember. And the tetanus shots are smaller now, but they still smart. So people always remember that they had one. Okay, you can have what we call plexus injuries. They're the brachial roots of your C5 through T1, which runs like the base of your neck, right, through T1, your thoracic area. And that is how you controls your function of, you know, moving your arms, your biceps, your extensors. Okay, and that can be a painful injury. That requires a lot of immobilization, supportive care. But what's important to know there, any injury from C5 to T1, which is just C is your cervical area, your neck. And how many cervical vertebrae are there? Seven. Right. That was very good. That's very good.
Breakfast at 7, lunch at 12, dinner at 5.
That was good. That was very good. But just think anything. That whole area, C5 through T1, you have a lot of your spinal nerves that run through there, but also a lot of your control of your autonomic nervous system. So, and what is it if your autonomic nervous system is not working very well? You're going to have trouble with temperature, right? You're going to have trouble regulating. What else? What's that? It can affect some of your breathing. Cervical area breathing, autonomic would be your, in addition to temperature, it would be your sweating, you know, control of temperature primarily is your main one, and it can be up to 1 month after the injury. So you may be taking care of them for that second week, and all of a sudden now you notice that they're sweating 1 minute and they're cold the next, and it can all be part of that injury. The lumbosacral, the lower ones, L4 and L5, you have your sciatic nerves, your femoral nerves run through there, and that may need to have surgical repair, but that also has a long healing process with it. Some of the hospitals don't send people right to rehab. Some keep them there and do physical therapy and rehab. Others will send you right out to a rehab center. You said guys were at BRIC, or the last group was? Okay. Most of them there for a while?
It depends on the physician.
Right. And what kind of injury they have. You know, some hospitals are specific with the rehab. All right, here's our different type of soft tissue injuries. And I'm sure we've all had an abrasion at one point in our life. They're extremely painful, right? You're scraping the epidermal and dermal layer of your skin. Sometimes they're called the strawberry. This person, unfortunately, has a significant abrasion all on his back. Looking at it, it's probably extremely painful. Also, you can see some of the blackened areas there, so it's dirty. It looks like they're trying to clean them off there a little bit. And we think this, you see the IV tubing here looks white. And he's probably got the Diprovan going, which is our sedative that knocks him out completely, because most people won't lie still for
skidded.
Yeah, skidded and scraped along. That's why when you see people riding their motorcycle, their bicycles without a shirt on, road rash is nasty. And we've seen some pretty nasty road rash. So that's your abrasion, epidermal and dermal scraping, not deep tissue, but it is also another area for infection. To anytime the skin's broken, you have a route for infection, and it's extremely painful because the nerves haven't been completely destroyed. Your avulsion is more your full thickness. It's a little deeper. Your degloving is a shearing force. It's a serious avulsion that's caused by shearing force. A lot of times it happens arms. We have people that have degloving injuries of the head, the scalp. Looks nasty. I mean, you can really literally see, like, take the flap and just peel it back. But they haven't damaged below that, and that's a degloving injury. Your contusion is more of a disruption of small vessels. Your laceration is an open wound or a splitting of the skin. And we've probably seen, all had one of those at one point or another. Not everything needs sutures now. Now they have the Dermabond they put on. There's different ways now for repairing these things. But anytime there's an opening, always be thinking infection. At a minimum, they're going to get, you know, the tetanus shot, and they may need antibiotics or an antibiotic ointment on the wound itself. Your puncture wound is your deep penetration, and the puncture wound carries the highest rate of infection because it's so deep and because it's right into the small layer of deep tissue.
That was the puncture?
That was your puncture. And again, it depends on what you're punctured with. A lot of times it's a nail. It's a dirty nail. It's something you step on that's usually not clean. Most people are not punctured with things that are, you know, stabbing. They don't wash the knife. It's not usually the clean butcher knife they get you with before.
Excuse me, is that sterile?
Yes, that's sterile, yes. Yeah. You wash that over. With your soft tissue injury, just keep in mind that you're always going to have a disturbance in your electrolyte balance, too, your fluid regulation, temperature, and now you have a direct route for microorganisms. So you just created a nice little pathway for them. Okay, so next we'll get into our joint injuries. Anybody had a dislocation before of a joint? No. No? Me neither. Hip? What?
Shoulder.
And the shoulder's most common. That's the most common one. We'll get into that one next. That's of the dislocations. The hips very commonly are dislocated, and once they're repaired, a dislocated hip, any dislocation is also then prone to re-dislocate. And when it dislocates, it actually separates. The two articular areas come out of that joint capsule. Sometimes they pop right back in by themselves. Sometimes they have to be reduced and put back in. And those are the patients that, you know, the longer that joint is out of place and not in the capsule, the more vascular damage you're doing. So that's why, you know, time is of the essence, and you want to try to have that done, you know, as quickly as possible. The subluxation is a partial displacement of bone from a joint. So the bone, it pops out just partially. Okay, and that can happen in a lot of different areas. It happens sometimes with the shoulder top, and I never realized until last week when I subluxed the rib right here. Turning, I was moving a crate, and the wheel stuck, and I turned, and I felt pop, snap, and it's definitely out. I'll have to show you later. You can see. And they said it won't go back in. It's just, it'll heal, but it'll never go completely down. And I have my own little, own little mark there. That little rabbit just trying to get behind the dryer to get a sock. But it's usually, you know, not an exciting injury. You know, no great story. Can't say that I, you know, saved someone's life, you know, dove after it. But, it does happen, and in a way that you don't expect. So there wasn't a lot of force there, energy. There wasn't a lot of mechanism there, but it was just the way you moved, and we've all done.
That happened to me when I was pregnant. Mm-hmm. Because of, what is it, relaxing, the hormone that moves?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
My ribs dislocated or popped.
Or you still have the lump there?
No, actually,
did you pop it back in?
To get rid of the pain, I laid, like, sort of on the pillow.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I actually felt better the next day, and I don't have a lump, so I don't know if I don't know what happened.
Well, maybe it did pop back, and maybe it didn't pop out, enough. Because they said a lot of times you get them more so with the shoulder, and they're not don't need surgical repair unless he said you're lucky that when it subluxed out and not in, because if it went in, and that's right what I was thinking, because I could just tell by the way it felt and it sounded. I'm like, well, I'm still breathing all right. Move my arms, you know. Because, so you know that, you know what to expect. But I'm like, well, can't you pop it back in? Because right away, you know, it's kind of like. But they said cosmetically, unless it really, and most people have the shoulders done, because they can stand out significantly. But as long as they're not doing any vascular damage, or said no risk of clots. You know, the more you know, sometimes you're like, you know, what's the complications of this? But with joint injuries, we talked about the most common one being our shoulder. And in about 90% of the shoulder dislocations, it's usually anterior. Anterior mean, you know, front, right? Posterior, back, right. And with 60% of those will recur in 2 years. So that's pretty high. Pretty high. So that's a large amount. We see a lot of them in the emergency room. A lot of the ones that don't go back on their own, we have to do conscious sedation. We actually have to relax someone completely with a lot of medication. And then, I don't know if you've ever seen them, pull pop it back in. But it can be pretty forceful. Did your family member have to have it?
Yeah. When he fell, it was a cat accident. You know, cats do things, got in the way. Fell on an implement in the weed whacker, something in the garage.
Uh-huh.
And immediately I could see his shoulder right here, took the suit coat off, and there it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got him over there. And they have like 5 or 6 different ways that they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the emergency room doctor said, we'll start with this way first, because it's the easiest, simplest. It looks weird. And
it does. Wrap a towel around.
Wrap it around and so forth. And I said, I'll just wait outside.
Right.
It's a whole different thing.
Right. It looks very primitive, actually, to see the way it's done, because they wrap a towel around from here to here, you know, and then the doctor's pulling, and the tech is usually helping.
Of course,
and
he had IV push Valium, mm-hmm. which is kind of weird. He said it hurt, but I didn't care. I just sort of watched it in amazement.
Right now, a lot of times we go with Versed and morphine. And it's considered a conscious sedation. So they have to be on a monitor, the patient does. They have to be pulse ox, you know, vital signs every 15 minutes. And you really have to watch them closely. And you really literally load people up to the point that they're so relaxed, and then you pop it back in. And some people it pops back very easily, and some people, you know, they're like, will it ever go back in? And we're all sweating in there. And they get, you know, so some people are very muscular, too. And the more muscular you are, you know, the harder it is to put things back in place. The elderly people, you know, the hips, they need to go to the OR for that. We will not reduce. We have reduced in the trauma room if it's something that's not perfusing, you don't have a pulse in that leg, but most hips need to go to the OR for repair. Looking at the hips, anterior most common. Once it's put back in place, you then have to have the sling, the swath, and it's still, you know, that area is injured, it's damaged. So you need to have a sling and swath put on for 1 to 6 weeks. That's the shoulder. And a lot of times, if you keep dislocating it, you'll tear your rotator cuff. And then you may have heard people that have said, I've had my rotator cuff torn or need to be repaired, and you find out that they had a history of a lot of dislocations in that same area. The hip, you get an anterior dislocation complication because the femoral artery runs right through there. We certainly don't want to be, you know, compressing that or lacerating that femoral artery. So with that, we carry a lot of bleeding damage. The avascular necrosis, that femoral head there, you're not getting perfusion. Those vessels are being compressed. The longer it takes for that to be fixed, the more chance they have of having permanent damage. And usually 6 hours is the window we like to go by from the time of the injury that you try to have that put back in place. So once 6 hours passes, then you're now starting to get into that area that can be cause permanent vascular damage.
And that has to be done in the OR?
Usually, they may do it if it's something significant and they don't have pulses. They may do it quickly in the ER or the trauma room, and then they will send them to the OR. And again, once it happens once, it can happen again. When you have these type of hips repaired or dislocated, that's why the patients that you may have that are on the hospital now, they have the abductor between their legs, the padded pillow.
Yeah.
Or whenever you roll them, you should always put a pillow between their legs so that they stay level, because when you roll them, and any unevenness can cause that to pop right back out again. And it really does. So they have you use the pillow or the abductor, it's called.
We have the abductor.
Yeah, we had
for the total hips, we have the abductor, but for just like a pinning,
right.
Then you use a pillow.
Then you use a pillow, right. And then we encourage them to do that even when they go home. You know, to always have the pillow between their legs, and especially when they roll. That bed rest, no weight bearing for 2 to 4 weeks. The knee, in the back of your knee, you have your popliteal artery. And that's a serious injury if you dislocate your knee and you compress that popliteal artery. You can cause a lot of vascular damage, a lot of bleeding from that area. So that should be reduced quickly, or you can lose, you know, function of the knee. When you don't have any blood flow to an area, you're going to lose, you're going to have cell death, and you can lose a lot of function. You may have them on the floors, and you can see that to a lot of patients, this can be a devastating injury because maybe they're a construction worker, or maybe you don't know what their career is, and they're out of work now for a long time, and it's a long process. So psychologically, they may, you know, be depressed, or they may need, you know, to help you work them through this situation, especially if they're having a lot of pain. Joint dislocations, we talked about the neurovascular compromise, you're concerned with that, and then your delayed, especially the avascular necrosis from delayed reduction. So 6 hours, I mentioned, was the window. We want to try to have that dislocation put back in place. The knee dislocations are immediate because of the popliteal artery. You should usually pop those right back in the emergency room. And I haven't seen a lot of those. I see a lot more of the shoulders. Yeah, sometimes it's right. And if he had both, then he probably did have something, congenital or something.
I wonder if he had a congenital
Right.
In the hips.
The socket just doesn't develop right, or you have the necrosis. And he would need a total hip replacement is what he's going to need. Right, he had one done, and then he was having.
Yeah.
And that's young, too, 29.
Yes.
Again, the 6 hours is the minimum. Sometimes it takes longer. Sometimes they have to be transferred to another hospital. Sometimes whatever surgery they need can't be done where they're at, and then they have to be moved to where a specialist can, because not every, depending on where it is in the socket, there's actual femoral head surgeries that even at Jersey Shore, we're trauma center, we have to send them to UMDNJ. There's only a surgeon there that does that type of surgery. It usually doesn't compromise their perfusion, so they have some time, but it's such a difficult surgery because of where it is that it has, this surgeon is well known and does them routinely, so they send them right there. Joint injuries, with them, they're always going to be painful. I don't think anybody would dislocate anything and not have a little bit of pain. It's usually deformed. You can tell that it's popped out. It doesn't look normal just by looking at it. You usually get a lot of swelling with that, edema. You will find inability. They may not be able to, like if I dislocate my shoulder, maybe I can't move my arm as well. I probably won't be able to go front and back if I have a dislocation. I won't be able to swing my arm around if it's a shoulder. And then your neurovascular compromise. So when you're assessing, you're always, you know, checking for the function, edema, deformity. And you want to have a good description. And if you've assessed them when they're in the hospital, your assessment should say, you know, how does it look, temperature, can they good range of motion, can they move their fingers, pulses, and all that is very important. This is a shoulder dislocation. It's kind of hard to see because it's dark with it popped forward. But you can just kind of see by looking at the person that they're not really symmetrical, just looking at the lung here and the chest. And I'm not sure what that is. Looks like a hand or a finger, yeah. Oh, it looks like the pen. There's also a crack in there. I think that's what he's pointing to.
Yeah, like
I see the crack. There's a fracture also. So they have a dislocation and they have a fracture. Where that finger is pointing, like right here. It looks like it goes like right to here, so it's almost completely through the bone. So you may have both. You may have a dislocation and a fracture. Fractured femur. You can share your experience there with your femur, but the femurs carry usually as a result of a significant force. Bless you. And even if people come in sometimes and tell you that they just tripped and fell, especially children, they shouldn't fracture their femurs that easy unless it's a pretty forceful impact, unless they have a pathological disease process going on. And with the, you can have it from a fall, motor vehicle accident, you can have it from penetrating wounds, certainly if anybody shoots you, stabs you, you can break your femur. The femoral head is the most common one that's fractured. And especially in the elderly, because they don't have a lot of the musculature to hold it in place. The connective tissue now, remember, gets very elastic, so it doesn't take much to break it. A lot of times they'll miss a step, and that's all it takes, and then that pops right out, and then it fractures, and then they fall on it. Blood loss, we talked about how significant that can be. This here is, what type of fracture is that? Well, we don't know if it's out of the skin. Not out of the skin. No. When the two bone ends completely, look at your diagram. Displaced, right. That's a displaced fracture, right. And you can see how far over that is. Now, just by looking at that, should that leg be shorter or longer than the other one?
Shorter.
Right. So that's why it's shorter. And you do sometimes you get rotation depending on where the fracture is. Depends on whether the leg. So if my leg would be shorter, it'd either be rotated out or it'll be rotated in. Okay, so it could be either way, depending on where the fracture is. Most commonly, it's externally rotated because it's usually up, you know, in the mid-range area or up a little higher. But it can be both, and sometimes they have a fracture and a dislocation, so you can't be sure, but the leg is always going to be shorter. So if you look at someone who's just fell, has a lot of pain, you notice that one leg's shorter than the other, and a fracture like that, it'll start to swell almost immediately. So you'll be able to see that that one femur compared to the other is going to be much larger. And you might even see that deformity because that's a nasty fracture. Was yours, you said, displaced, compound, open? Right. And they have what we have is that hair traction splint that the pre-hospital people carry. It's a traction splint. And what it does is it just pulls it back. And what it does is it reduces it. It stabilizes it. It doesn't reduce it completely, but it immobilizes it and stabilizes the femur. It's called a hair traction splint. There's one for children and there's one for adults.
What do? They actually pull it? Don't they have to, like, kind of pull the person?
Well, you have a little ankle thing on there. Well, one person pulls the leg back, turns it, and pulls it back. The other person, then the splint comes all the way up and goes right up here under your iliac area there. It sits right at the top of your buttocks, and it's all whole metal splint, and then it has with the ankle hitch here, and then it has a little dial on it, a little metal pin, and you turn the traction, and what you do is you stabilize it in place. Although it seems primitive, it really does help, and it cuts down on the muscle spasms, cuts down on the bleeding significantly, and it does decrease their pain tremendously. It's just a hard thing for someone to pull and put it, you know, hold it while they put the traction splint on.
Initially it hurts,
yes.
How do you know that you're reducing it enough? Like, do you do an X-ray on the spot?
No, you just
eyeball.
You're just taking it, you're turning it and pulling back. Not a lot, just enough to stay, because you're really stabilizing it. You're not reducing it. And then you, the splint fits exactly on the leg, so you know. And you're always measuring that splint 6 to 12 inches longer than your unaffected leg. And then you just splint it in place. So there's no X-ray that's done. And you just check your pulses, you know, in your foot before and after. And it's only to be used for an isolated fractured femur. So you don't always see people put it on. If they think there's a pelvis involved or you think you have the hip involved, then you really can't put it on because you'll take care of the femur, but then you may cause more damage too. So although I've been out in the field for 20-some years now, I've only seen it put on like twice in the field. But in the hospital, we put it on the trauma bay sometimes just so then you can get them to the OR to have it repaired because it really does cut down on the muscle spasms. It keeps the bleeding down.
You could do that right out in the field, mm-hmm. like in a trauma situation. Mm-hmm. And then they put the splint and everything right on?
Right on.
Transport
them to the hospital like that. You put that hair traction on. Then you put them on a backboard, on the stretcher, and in you go.
But that takes good assessment.
Yeah.
Good assessment.
To determine if that's all you're dealing with.
Right, and that's why it's not done as often, because it's time-consuming, and then they're not always sure that that's just what they have. If it's a compound, though, we don't want to do that, because you don't want to pull the bone back in. So only if it's a closed fractured femur. And if you hear hair, that's what it's called. It was named after the gentleman who invented it. It has nothing to do with rabbits or...
The name of the person that invented the hospital gown. Dr. Seymour Butts.
That's good.
She's all concerned.
That's good. That was good. That's very good. With the fractured femur, we talked about edema of the thigh. You want to keep an eye on that if you're taking care of them on the floor. That's when you want to definitely get that tape measure out. And measure the circumference at least once a shift and note if there's any changes because just by looking at it, you can't tell how much swelling there is. So compare and make sure you're measuring, you know, the same spot on each thigh of how much edema you have. And if you have a significant amount of swelling after they've already had their intervention, then there's either some bleeding going on or there's something significant that needs to be corrected. Deformity of the thigh, you'll see, and then you may hypovolemic shock because of their volume loss. Open fractures, I think we've stress now that you're very, very concerned with infection. Infection, you note one by the high temperature, looking at the site may look red and discolored, and the poor wound healing. Osteomyelitis is an infection in the bone and in its marrow. And that's a serious infection because, one, a lot of times it takes a while to surface, and it can last for a very long time. Patients go to rehab, they still have the infection. You have them come back to the hospital because it takes a long time to take care of that infection. If there's other causes, sometimes they have a broken bone and the infection had nothing to do with the broken bone, but maybe they had strep. Maybe they had picked up a bloodborne pathogen while they were in the hospital. They're diabetics. People with sickle cell disease are very prone to have osteomyelitis occur. So, again, it can happen initially or it can happen, you know, down the road. So it may be a couple weeks after. But just because it's undetected, it actually binds right to the bone and the tissue, and you don't see it right away. You may also have sepsis. And when you become septic, what does that mean? Where did the infection go if you're septic?
Blood,
right. And the infection that's gone to your bloodstream, you're now septic. And that's very serious. And that's something we need to be really aggressive, and that could, you know, put you into a severe state of shock that can actually, you know, has a mortality with it. The grades, we talked about the three grades of skin tissue injury. Which one's the worst?
Three.
Right. So soft tissue, good. Here's another picture of an open fracture. You can see you have obvious skin disruption there. When you splint this, immobilize it. Where do you want to immobilize it? Where would our splint go?
Above the blood.
That's
site,
the arm.
Right. Above the.
It's an arm, believe it or not.
Yeah. You want to do a tourniquet above the bleeding, right?
Yeah, because it's elbow here, the humerus up there. It's a nasty fracture. You always want to splint above and below. So you should have that full arm completely immobilized, right? Yeah, the shoulder is way up there, like over here. Yeah, so that's a, we don't know what caused that injury. You know, that could have been an explosion. You know, so there could be multiple fractures. That could be somebody who was shot. We don't know. I don't remember what this one was from, to be honest with you, with what caused it. But you can see just by looking at it, you have a lot of fractures. You can see all this swelling in here, right? You have an open wound here, an open wound there. The bleeding is controlled right now, but it's something you want to keep an eye on because that can ooze out. A lot of times, you know, you're looking over here, which is great, but what's underneath there? You know, maybe there's a big laceration underneath. We've had people that are laying in a pool, and you don't notice it until you roll them, and then all of a sudden, you know, they've lost a lot of blood. It's all laying underneath them. So you may have, see the bone. This one, you know, you can't see it from the picture here. Probably a lot of pain. Sometimes though, we have a lot of people that come in that fall like this that are under the influence of a number of things, and they don't even know that it's broken, and they're coming flopping away. You're like, sit down. But so you want to immobilize that. Immobilize, get that pillow under them. If you have nothing else, the pillow is your best friend for a splint because there's nothing you can't splint with a pillow. So you don't need the fancy casting and all that. Pain and neurovascular compromise, so we'd be checking pulses, right? We check a radial pulse on this person. You might want to check their brachial pulses, see if they're getting perfusion, if they're moving their fingers, and how much bleeding is associated with that. Looking at this, this is our amputation, and they can be partial or complete. This is a complete, but I don't know how well you can see here. That's considered jagged. That's not a guillotine. A guillotine is a complete slice all the way through. Those are the ones that patients actually do better with because it's the vessel's tamponade off completely. Here you have ripped, torn, twisted. They're a lot harder to reattach. This was being used as a tourniquet. What's the best way to stop bleeding? Pressure points. Where would the pressure point be there? Right. You need to know. Right. You need to know where your pressure points are because if you can compress that pressure point, you're doing just as good a job as by putting the tourniquet on. You're preventing any possible circulation there might be to that area. Usually, the fingers. We see the hands a lot. And again, you always have to remember it's life over limb. You know. You may lose that extremity, but if the person's not breathing and they're in hypovolemic shock and now they're in kidney failure, you need to be concerned with that first. The fingers do the best, believe it or not. The multiple digits, children do the best, thumb, forearm. And the guillotine does the best, again, because it's a complete slice through and the vessel's tamponade off immediately. With the amputations, you have some obvious tissue loss. There's usually no missing that they have an amputation. Hemorrhaging, they may have some bleeding. They may have a lot of bleeding. They may not have any. With the guillotine, you would think they'd be pumping out. They don't usually bleed much at all because everything does tamponade right off. With the ripped or the torn or the sheared, they will have a lot of bleeding. So they're always watch them for needing fluids. They may need surgery. They may put a flap over it just to cover that area of skin, or they may be able to reattach. And the quicker it's reattached, the better outcome they have. We've done a lot of amazing things around here. Jersey Shore, the girl in the parkway, they reattached her her arm. There are certain surgeries, though, they have to be sent to New York. Bellevue, I think, is still the main reattachment center here in the country. And some things can, some things can't. But, again, even a finger is devastating to someone. So psychologically, that's something you always want to keep in mind. Crush injuries are a little bit different. You can have an amputation and a crush injury. A crush injury is when you actually have things all compressed. They're difficult to treat because of the muscle. Everything's compressed. You've crushed. You know, if a cement block landed on me and I crushed my hand, you know, the bones are broken, the vessels are compressed, the muscles are compressed. And with that comes what? A lot of swelling. And that's where we are really concerned, because now we're going to get so much swelling. So they usually get hemorrhage, a lot of fluid loss. With those patients, you can develop what we call compartment syndrome. You have a lot of compartments in your body. The body has 46 compartments, okay, and 38 of those are in your arms and legs. They're little tiny compartments inside of your extremities. So they're tiny compartments. Again, there's 46 in the body, and 38 of those are just in your arms and legs. So that's where the majority of those compartments sit. Most commonly, they're in the lower legs. Okay, so when we with crush injuries, we're worried about this is a bad crush injury to the lower leg, and you can see that's been compressed. It's open. It's you're going to have a lot of swelling with that. That whole leg can completely blow up. You're going to get pain, hypovolemic shock, and with this patient, we're concerned with his pulses, and that he's going to develop compartment syndrome. I'm going to show you next what the compartment syndrome is. Yeah, I'll show you. I have a good picture. Am I going too fast? I feel like I'm rushing to finish up, but maybe I could save some of this for Monday. If I need to go over it again Monday. This compartment syndrome can develop from any crush injury. It's always common because of the compression, and then you could lose function distal to the injury. So that's why you always want to check pulses, see how well it's perfusing. The next one shows you compartment syndrome occurs when you have a increase in the fascial compartment, which is where the muscle is, and you have those little tiny compartments. More commonly, it's in the lower leg. The next picture I have actually shows you what the compartment looks like. It can be caused from external forces, which is that's why we don't put the casts on right away. You know, years ago, remember, you broke something, boop, you got a cast put right on. Now, that's why we wait till some of that swelling goes down. Now they put the hard piece on the bottom, and then they wrap it with elastic gauze, and we don't compress it completely, because we found with a lot of our casting and a lot of our immobilization that we were causing compartment syndrome to occur from that compression.
Grant, you don't have to be concerned today about timing, because in this, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but nutrition is canceled today.
Yay! Okay. All right. Okay. So they won't be coming in the door as a blah blah blah. Yeah. I don't want to have to talking faster than usual. You guys would all be in trouble. With compartment syndrome, you get again the external internal forces. So it can be caused from the injury, that now you have all that edema, and that's what's causing the compartment pressure. Or it can be an external force source, such as the cast mass trousers they used to put on years ago. Anything that compresses. And a lot of times we do a wonderful job with bandaging, but sometimes they're just too tight. I don't know if you ever notice people put splints on and bandages. You really have to make sure what the perfusion was before you put that splint on or your bandage, and after. A lot of people don't check it well after. And
I see a lot of patients come back from the OR and have, like, their ankle done. Mm-hmm. And, like, they'll have, like, the hard cast on top and then the hard cast on the front, but it's cut open.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or a lot of
right. Once that swelling increases, you really have to, that first 24, 48 hours.
It's really like there's a lot of discomfort. Like mm-hmm. The patient will let you know.
Oh, they'll tell you right away, right.
It really hurts. Like, mm-hmm. And it's not controlled by pain meds.
No, and if it's not controlled by pain meds, that's when you know that you have too much pressure there. And that's usually when that's an first indication that there's a problem, that something's compressing too tight.
And also, mm-hmm. If they put it on too early, like my little sister, when she broke her leg when she was a baby, they put it on and she was so swollen that when the swelling went down, she crawled right out of the cast.
Yeah, right.
Still have it when
You still have, yeah. So they, so they've changed that practice law, and that's exactly why. Now we have, and if I can, next week I'll bring in where you, it's in a soft pack. It's all folded up, and they dip it in water. It's got a little bit of foam on it and a hard surface, and as soon as it's dipped in water, they mold it right to wherever, but it's only covering one side, either anterior or posterior. And then once it's wet, they mold it, and then they wrap the elastic gauze around it, and that's how we cast now.
Like fiberglass or something?
It's not even fiberglass. It's hard.
Yeah.
Right. It acts just like the fiberglass cast, and then a lot of times, like a week or two later, the orthopedic doctors will put a regular cast on, so you don't have that souvenir for 10 years. Compartment syndrome develops because you have a prolonged... What does ischemia mean? Oxygen, right. Loss of oxygen to the tissues, and that causes death of that tissue. So eventually that's going to not only cause pain, but then you're going to lose function. So that's why that compartment pressure we want to stop. This gives you a cross-section going through the leg. Here's the tibia and the fibula. Looking at the lower leg, here's the plate going right through the lower leg, and that's what it looks like in there. Here are all these are little compartments inside your leg. So there's a lot of them. So there's a lot of different areas that can be compressed and build up a lot of pressure.
My patient 2 weeks ago had compartment syndrome. He fell on, he broke his radius.
He broke his radius and developed.
And he had to keep it hung. And then when I initially had walked in, I didn't know what it was. Like you're supposed to, when you do preclinically, you walk in to say hi to them. And I thought it looked like the antibiotics, the small antibiotics mm-hmm. that they have. But it was the measurement. They had it in his arm and it was measuring the pressure in his arm. He had that.
Continuously.
He wasn't close.